This is the IBJ podcast for the week of February 22nd, 2021. I'm Mason King. Welcome back to the podcast, everybody. The United States has been vaccinating as many people as it can since the beginning of the year, and positivity rates, hospitalizations, and deaths have been trending lower. The predictions for putting the pandemic safely behind us are all over the board. A professor at Johns Hopkins School of Medicine said last week we could reach herd immunity as early as April. That got a lot of pushback from the medical community. President Biden said he hoped things would be more or less back to normal by Christmas. One thing seems for sure, even when we get our equilibrium back, some of the businesses that have let their employees work remotely will still let them do so, at least some of the time. The tech giant Salesforce said as much on February the 9th, which sent a shiver down the spine of downtown Indianapolis. Salesforce is one of the biggest employers downtown, with 2,100 workers. And we know several other companies with big offices downtown are at least contemplating the same thing, now that many employees have been able to prove they can work remotely. This is likely discouraging news for the downtown businesses that rely on office workers to survive, like restaurants or office supply stores. And if companies decide they don't need as much space, that presents a challenge for the office buildings that define downtown, at least as we see it on the horizon. We have three guests today to discuss this trend of reevaluating how much of a workforce you need at the office and what shrinking that footprint means for the vitality of downtown. We'll start with Mickey Shuey, IBJ's real estate reporter. He'll be followed by Adam Broderick, managing director and market lead for the Indianapolis office of the commercial real estate brokerage JLL. And then restaurateur Ed Rudisill, who co-owns Siam Square in Fountain Square and the neighboring bar and eatery, the Inferno Room. Let's start with Mickey. Joining us is Mickey Shuey, real estate reporter for the IBJ. Thanks for making time, Mickey.
Thanks for having me, Mason.
The announcement from Salesforce earlier this month really seemed to crystallize what people are fearing is the effect that the pandemic could have long term on the downtown office market and the businesses that rely on the people who work in offices. So tell me, what did Salesforce actually say on February 9th? What is it going to allow its employees to do?
So yeah, Salesforce said on February 9th that it's going to permit its employees who can to work from home or work remotely at least a few days per week. It'll range depending on the need for them to be in the office. Some may have to come to the office once a week. Others may have to come in three times, four times per week. And of course, there will be some likely upper management that will have to remain in the office daily. But it really is giving flexibility to its employees to work from home or from remote locations, so that way they're not always in the office.
And this is after the pandemic has subsided.
Correct. That will continue after the pandemic subsides.
So how many employees does Salesforce have downtown?
Salesforce has about 2,100 employees. Most of them are in Salesforce Tower, right in Circle and between the Circle and Ohio Street. But then there are some in the Gibson Building on Michigan Street. We do know that Salesforce has 13 floors in Salesforce Tower, including the 47th floor.
For folks who are kind of familiar with how this stuff works, Salesforce has its name on the building, but it doesn't own the tower, right?
Correct. Actually, the building was just purchased by an Oklahoma City firm last month for, I believe, is $192.5 million.
Tallest office building in the state, nicest class A office building in the state. And these things, it's kind of weird. It seems like they've been changing hands once every few years recently. You know, the investment market for these big buildings has been pretty hot.
Yeah. And actually, I was speaking with a source recently, and they told me that the building actually probably could have gone for a little bit more, but because of the market conditions, the seller was willing to settle a little bit.
So we have a few other examples of big downtown office users reconsidering whether to allow employees who are working from home to continue doing so in some manner. Tell me about Rolls-Royce.
So Rolls-Royce is looking at what it's going to do with this space as well. It has about 400,000 square feet of office space downtown. A good chunk of that, most of it really, is at 450 South Meridian Street in that big building just south of Slippery Noodle. And they have 2,000 people working in that building. But the company said recently that it hasn't made any final decisions yet on what's going to happen with its facilities. They said that, of course, most of their employees outside of the production facilities have been working remotely since the pandemic began, and that that will likely continue for a while. And because of that, they're going to evaluate their office needs, including whether they need to have all 400,000 square feet.
And then we have Eli Lilly and Company, a pharmaceutical giant, which maintains its corporate headquarters downtown, as well as some research and manufacturing operations. What is the status of their space needs downtown?
So they really have not shared how much space specifically they have, but we do know that they have 11,000 employees in Indianapolis and about 4,000, about one, a little over one third of them have jobs that require them to be on site working positions such as research or manufacturing. The rest are working from home, 7,000 people. And that's obviously had a big impact on restaurants and other retailers. But right now, Eli Lilly is exploring how it's going to utilize office space moving forward as well.
So these are the companies that we've asked. Are we safe in assuming that other companies are also reconsidering their space needs and letting some employees remain remote?
Absolutely. I think that there's no doubt that other companies are moving in that direction or exploring those options right now. I think that there's a good chance that a lot of especially larger firms, including potentially law offices, are considering their space needs. That doesn't necessarily mean that they're going to leave downtown, but they honestly would be silly not to, it seems, in this environment, to at least evaluate their needs for office space.
What are experts saying about the potential effect of that on downtown?
Jury's still out a little bit, but a lot of people, including Downtown Indy Inc. and real estate brokers, several of them are concerned that could really decimate the retail and restaurant industries downtown that have already been hard hit by the coronavirus pandemic. Fewer people working downtown. There's generally about 155,000 people working downtown, at least there were before the pandemic. So we're not really clear how many people are going to come back to work after that. And if more office users are evaluating their needs, that could mean that only a chunk of those people will come back to downtown on a daily basis.
So I'd assume potentially could have effect on any kind of retail, any kind of restaurants, potentially parking.
Right. So exactly. That's really the big question. What isn't it going to affect? Because it's also going to affect the value of office space. There could possibly be a drop in demand for office space if people are cutting back on their needs. So that could lower the per square foot price of office space.
Do we know what office workers are saying about what they want in terms of working remotely versus coming into an office?
Yes. So a lot of people want to work remotely, but also have the flexibility to collaborate with their neighbors, and a lot of them want to be able to do that in an office environment. That information comes to us from a few different areas, but specifically a study that was done by Doris Research here in Indianapolis that included 5 local companies. It was a survey of 15 companies in the Midwest and included 5 local companies, and a majority of the employees that were talked to said that they want to be able to have flexibility, but they also want to have more collaboration opportunities. So it's a bit of a paradox, but a lot of office users seem to be heading in that direction. Now, Doris found that a lot of the challenges could come from striving for a hybrid model because a lot of employers don't necessarily know how to provide that in an effective manner, how to configure their spaces in a way that's conducive to that type of work. So I think there's going to be a learning curve over the next few years for companies that are either pursuing that model or exploring that model to be effective for all their workers.
Well, that's it. Let me check in with a couple more of our sources and we'll see what we come up with.
Great. Thanks for having me.
Let's talk now with Adam Broderick of real estate brokerage JLL about the potential disruption to the office market. And he'll be followed by Ed Rudisill, who co-owns Siam Square in Fountain Square and the neighboring bar and eatery, the Inferno Room.
For our next guest, I'm pleased to welcome Adam Broderick, Managing Director and Market Lead for the Indianapolis office of the commercial real estate brokerage, JLL. Adam, thanks for making time today.
Appreciate it, Mason. Glad to be here.
For folks who aren't in the business, what does a commercial real estate brokerage do?
Well, we have a variety of service lines, but I would say we are all things real estate except for ownership is an easy way to explain it.
In terms of this story, let's say I'm someone who's looking to lease some office space, I would call you and you would help me.
That would be fantastic.
Or I have office space and maybe I'm looking to move or expand, I would call you.
Exactly. Yep. That's kind of the core brokerage side of the business.
How big is the downtown office market in square feet? I don't know if folks at home are going to really be able to conceptualize that exactly, but I'm curious, how big is it?
Sure. So it's about 13 million square feet in total. And of that, around 7 million is what we'd categorize as Class A office space. So your Salesforce Tower, Market Tower, Regions, BMO, the larger tower buildings, kind of the high profile buildings comprise about 7 million of that 13 million square feet.
And then the other stuff is what, like Class B and C, I would assume?
Yes. Yep.
And B, as I recall from my real estate reporting days, it's kind of like a like an older renovated building.
You could probably talk to five different brokers and get five different opinions on kind of fringe A versus B, B versus C buildings. There's no clear cut definition to it. A lot of B buildings have turned into properties that folks would consider A at this point through renovation process. We call it more of a creative class where you've taken something old and made it new and old at the same time and pretty cool.
In that 13 million square feet, do we have a sense of how many people work in downtown's office space?
You know, I would say a good guesstimate would be somewhere around 40 to 45,000 people. There's around 17% vacancy in the market. And so taking that out and assuming that there's probably about four people for every 1,000 feet of lease space in the downtown market, we're going to wind up somewhere in that ballpark.
So we already know that big employers like Salesforce and Rolls-Royce and Eli Lilly and Company are looking closely at allowing some office employees to continue working remotely, at least some of the time. Do you have a sense of maybe what the percentages of all employers downtown who are thinking the same thing, wondering, you know, maybe this is the change that we need to continue long-term?
You know, we hear rumblings here and there in the industry, real estate folks find out typically before others of pending, you know, decisions like that, because it's obviously affects the decisions that are made in our space. I don't know that there's, you know, I've heard rumblings of other major employers that I probably won't mention because I don't know if they're true or not. And I don't want to upset a bunch of folks, more so downsizing their footprint than necessarily saying, hey, everybody go work from home. I would say that I think the work from home acronym and topic is slightly overblown. In my mind, and a little bit off the rail, but I know what our topic is here, and I think it all plays in. In my mind, people have been working from what I like to call work from anywhere, more so than work from home. But people have been doing that for quite a while before the pandemic. It just became more talked about, and companies made firmer, you know, policies around it. But tech companies and you know, real estate companies and folks, if they're sitting behind their desk the entire time, they're probably not being totally productive anyhow. They're out in the field doing things. They need a heads down time for paperwork, and it's better at home than in a cube next to somebody, whatever it is. So I think these behaviors have been going on for quite a while. COVID just formalized some of it, and it became a hot topic. You know, in my mind, this is job specific, not company specific, meaning the job you do will detail where you need to sit, and you'll work from home or anywhere if your job doesn't require you to be there, and you'll work from the office if it does. And there's probably a blend of a lot right in the middle between that.
What, you know, potentially could be the impact with, you know, one being maybe a slightly shorter line at Starbucks, to 10 being maybe there's a, you know, a few office buildings that are just going to go empty. What do you think the impact is going to be?
I think that the impact on the office market is going to be quality driven. We were seeing it before the pandemic. I think the flight to quality will be exacerbated by this, and that'll be the outcome. Meaning, if you're a commodity Class B building, it's going to be much harder for you to attract a tenant to your building. Because as an employer, if you're saying, hey, I'm Salesforce, it's okay for you to work from home a couple of days, but I want you in the office 2 to 3 days a week. And when you're in the office, we're going to focus on our team meetings and our culture and our gatherings and you know, back to that concept of creative collisions or whatever, that's what we're going to focus on. Your task as an employer and then your task as an owner of real estate is to provide a space that's conducive to that. And then employees get excited to come down to. And so if you have commodity space that's easily replicated by everyone else, you've done nothing to differentiate yourself versus going into a building that offers a high level of amenities, you know, common to all the tenants, and then also designing your space in a manner that provides the employee something they can't have at home, whether it's technology based or the food and drink and snacks and the break room environment is second to none, whatever that might be for your culture and your company. I think that will be what drives real estate decisions. And so there will probably be some impact to occupancy, especially in the short term. But I think it will be how the office space is reimagined through that process. And what is its function? Is it simply a place to put a desk for heads down work? Or is it a place that is, you know, 75% of its job is to bind you to your company and create a culture and an environment that makes you excited to be where you are for work and make you want to come in?
Have you personally heard from clients about, you know, their interest in either downsizing or maybe when they renew, not renewing for as much space as they normally would have?
You know, it's kind of all over the board. The sublease market has picked up a ton of inventory in the last 9 months. That kind of tells you two things. One, it could be folks shedding excess space, and others is some folks trying to see if there's a market to shed all their space. I think that some of those subleases will stay dark and expire and become vacancy. And I think some of the subleases folks will bring back people into those spaces and you know, they put them on the market. If we can find some upfront quick cost savings, we'll take it. We'll reevaluate our office space needs in a year. If it doesn't sublease, we'll just move back into it and operate. So kind of early to tell exactly what it's going to be. Will the vacancy rate in downtown Indy go up? Yes, it will.
So I know there's a lot of concern as well for all the businesses that depend on these 50,000 office workers. I mean, the obvious ones are restaurants. Are you hearing anything about the restaurant market? I know, I mean, there are a lot of places that have closed and a lot of places that are kind of hanging on by their fingernails.
Yeah, I mean, there's movement both in positive and negative directions in the restaurant business. My, you know, personal thought is that COVID exposed some businesses that probably were doomed anyhow. And others that were going to make it are going to make it. And they're fighting through tough times. And I don't want to downplay what folks have gone through by any means. But in my mind, for downtown, our topic, downtown Indianapolis, our general topic, the office workers are extremely important. But equally as important are the sports and conventions. And Indianapolis is Indianapolis because of sports and conventions. And it's spawned a bunch of other things. And it's created this downtown that prior to COVID was a place that we admired. And I think it's probably a little overstated how, you know, the quote unquote downfall of downtown Indy. Let's see what it's like in July after we've had a Final Four, 3 weeks of March Madness, the Colts are in training camp and the Pacers are revving up to open up, you know, the renovated Banker's Life. And I think that will heal a lot of wounds quickly in my mind, and it'll bring the restaurants back. I mean, the announcement that you guys had out today that 25% of the stadium will be filled for the NCAA games, that's huge for the bars and restaurants. You know, I heard someone mention the other day that St. Elmo's and Harry Nizzi's does their beefsteak event yearly. And this year, instead of 2 days, it's 4 days because of social distancing, but it's sold out immediately. And so folks want to come back downtown. In my mind, I toured the Banker's Life updates the other day. They're phenomenal. It will get me off my couch and in downtown to see a ball game, that's for sure. And so I think that the office part is important, but we were built on sports. And now that those are coming back, that'll remind everybody why we love to be downtown.
When you said that you think that there will be greater vacancy downtown, any predictions?
No, not numerical predictions. I just, you know, in my mind, I'd rather own a Class A building, you know, even though the rents are higher than a Class B building, because I think that flight to quality will be real. And so, you know, maybe what you see is that the vacancy rate, you know, it's in the 15 to 17% range overall. I think you'll probably see it stay steady, you know, maybe even a potential over a 36-month window to decrease in the Class A product. And you'll probably see the inverse in the lower end product.
Is it possible that the Class A rents would come down a little bit, or at least that they wouldn't expand any further for a while?
Yeah, they'll stay stagnant at probably best. And you might, you know, the activity is so slow right now. What will be interesting to see is there's been a lot of can kicking going on in the real estate world. The decisions our clients make are long-term decisions. They're signing between 5, 10, and sometimes 15-year leases. And no one's been making those long-term decisions right now. They've been doing either nothing if they're able to do so, or a short-term extension. And so at some point, we're going to have kind of a glut of deals come to the market, and there'll be activity, and people will be willing to make long-term decisions. And so we'll find out then if it's enough activity to hold rates steady or not.
All right. Well, best of luck to you when the glut hits.
Yeah, absolutely.
For our next guest, I'm pleased to welcome Ed Rudisill, the co-owner of Siam Square and the Inferno Room in Fountain Square. Hey, thanks for making the time, Ed. I appreciate it.
Yeah, I appreciate it. Always make time for you guys.
For folks who aren't familiar with Siam Square, can you describe it?
We are a traditional Thai restaurant. We've been open since 2008 in Fountain Square. So we've kind of seen the whole wave of the resurgence of the area and, you know, the trendiness and the kind of art community moving in and independent restaurants and, you know, just kind of a thriving, bustling scene that we've seen pre-COVID.
How many seats do you guys have?
Oh, gosh. Well, it's been a while since I've double checked my numbers because we don't really use them any longer. And well, we did a remodel 4 months prior to COVID-19 hitting. So, I mean, our indoor dining is practically shut down. We have approximately 88 seats.
Or you would.
So they're not in use, you know, yeah, at the moment.
How is business at the moment?
It's terrible. You know, I mean, anybody that says otherwise is either at a chain restaurant or is just not giving you the full story. You know, sales are insanely down from year to year, month to month. And, you know, we have the benefit of having been here for the last, you know, over a decade. So we can do comparisons through two different recessions and, you know, any number of events, you know, elections, all these things. And so, yeah, looking at this after 12 years of work, it's pretty disheartening to kind of see the numbers hit the brakes in the way that they have.
And you're open for lunch and dinner?
Yes, lunch and dinner.
So apropos to our story, you are located less than a mile from the Eli Lilly and Company campus.
So yeah, we're actually located much closer than that. I think most people don't realize how close Fountain Square is to the downtown area. We are 1 mile to the Circle. So Lilly's campus is just, you know, a few blocks away. You know, at least there, I guess this is the East campus. You know, they kind of take over the whole south end of the city. But yeah, we are located directly, I mean, just a few blocks away from their corporate headquarters.
And how big a chunk of your clientele do you think is Lilly employees?
You know, at lunchtime, it's a pretty good chunk. A lot of Lilly employees go to work an hour earlier than a lot of the rest of the city. So whereas, you know, we think about it at 8 to 5 jobs, a lot of Lilly employees are working 7 to 4. And so they're ready for lunch an hour earlier than most other downtown office workers. So we start to see an influx of Lilly workers right at 11 a.m. when we open, or we used to anyhow. And so that would really comprise the bulk of our business between 11 a.m. and noon, while everybody was kind of getting ready for their own lunch breaks at 12 o'clock. And so, yeah, I would say, you know, across the board, Lilly comprised one heck of a lot of our lunch. I would say probably 40%, 50% of our lunch sales across a normal time.
Well, so this really must give you pause. I mean, this idea that Lilly is at least looking at allowing a lot of its workers to either stay remote or just to build in more flexibility into their schedule.
Right. Yeah, we've been hearing these rumors really, I guess, effectively since about 2 months into the quarantine and the shelter in place orders that we got in early 2020. And so numbers that we've been hearing over the last 8-9 months, Lilly won't be back to work until the end of 2021, Salesforce 2022, Anthem, Farm Bureau, you know, all of these other office workers that are major, major employers in downtown Indianapolis, not really being required to come back onto the corporate campus until at least the end of 2021, if not heading into 2022. And like you said, just the kind of corporate culture changing as well. And those are the things that really concern us because, you know, we being in Fountain Square, obviously, like I said, our lunch business, that first hour is almost pure Lilly employees. But, you know, after that, at 12 o'clock, we're Salesforce, Farm Bureau, Anthem, you know, those people come in. And so with all those people out of the city, we are now seeing at this point, and again, mind you, we aren't really doing dine-in. We have a couple of hours where we can do very limited seating, you know, by reservation only at this point, because we just don't have a staff any longer. You know, we're really only getting 8-9 people a day really asking to come in. And so you go from 140 people a day, 160 people a day, just at lunch between 11 a.m. and 1 p.m., now we're down to a dozen. And, you know, that's the kind of numbers that we're talking about here. And, you know, and I would count ourselves lucky in that we still actually have business, and our evening business, you know, is still moving forward. We're primarily have transitioned to a carry out model at this point. It's the really only thing that can allow any restaurant to survive at this point, is we've all had to pivot to grocery sales. And in some cases, in our case, you know, carry out delivery with third party services. But, you know, all those businesses that you mentioned in the Mile Square that are immediately in downtown proper, a lot of places really peg their business to downtown office workers. You know, you see those delis with kind of generic names that just says deli on the outside, or, you know, sandwich shop. You know, those places have built their concept around having office workers built in to their kind of traffic on the sidewalk. And with that gone, I mean, this is going to completely decimate downtown hospitality, especially at lunchtime.
So if there's any kind of silver lining here, is, I mean, you kind of have a sense of how things might play out. How do you as a restaurateur prepare for a shift like that in the long term?
I'm not sure that there's really anything that we can do to prepare. I mean, what you're doing is you're bracing for it. It's not really a preparation versus really just kind of bracing for the impact. And there's really only so much you can do in that case as well. Most of us out here are right now surviving on money that isn't ours or wasn't ours. We are surviving on government loans, grants, anything that we can ask for and anything that's been offered to try to keep our head above the water or even at the waterline. I would say that most of us don't have our head above the water, but, you know, we're kind of, if we're lucky, we're right at the waterline. It's very hard because the only way that we can make that happen is through these grant programs. And, you know, with the second round of PPP draws, that seems to hopefully, we're counting on that being a bridge to patio season, where we can hopefully, you know, tread water for a little bit longer until something fleshes out some sort of solution and we can see what's on the other side of this tunnel. We don't really know what to expect. So as far as preparing for it, you know, we can't prepare for all possibilities.
In August of last year, you closed two of your restaurants. Is that right?
September 5th. Yeah, we closed Rook and we closed Black Market. Both of them had been open for many, many years. Black Market was 10 years old. Yeah.
Yeah.
Both we lasted 10 years at Black Market and we were 7 years at Rook. Mm-hmm. So it really hurt. But again, you know, those, we had a really hard time transitioning and pivoting. And that's what's happening, I think, across the board in hospitality, is we were upscale dine-in restaurants. We never really had a big slice of carryout business. And so as we did pivot to a carryout model as we needed to, we just really weren't in kind of immediate consciousness when people decided to order out. And that's why we were able to survive at Siam Square, because we were already had a lot of carryout business. We ended up closing in September, like I said, the first week of September, because that's when the PPP money ran out. Like I said, when you're living on borrowed money, I've been saying lately, you know, you're living on borrowed dime. You know, it's if it doesn't continue, it's not sustainable. And anybody in business knows that. Anybody even outside of business knows that. You can't sustain a business forever on money that isn't yours. That bill comes due. And so as, you know, they gave us that bridge, it was really a bridge to nowhere. And I got accused of being very pessimistic about the hospitality industry at that time. But the things that I talked about last March, last April, last May are now coming to fruition. And, you know, I had said at the time that we were going to see mass closures in restaurants at the end of summer. And that's exactly what we saw, as our patios became unusable due to weather and the PPP funds ran out. And, you know, our labor costs were at 1,200%, you know, in some cases. I guess that's a little ridiculous, but I mean, I'm thinking of number of dollar amounts, but we're talking, you know, 200% labor in some cases, because you had to spend that money in a very specific way to be forgiven the loan. So we were just running up those numbers. And now that we're seeing a second round of the PPP, it's hopefully a bridge to somewhere this time, because if it's not, it's going to be another round of mass closures. I really, really sincerely hope that that's not the case. I've already seen too many of my friends get hurt, you know, and livelihoods and, you know, businesses. And not only that, but you think about the workers. And I just came from Restaurant Depot and ran into my old chef from Rook and my old sous chef. And we just sat and talked, and you know, they're in the same situation now. They still are having a hard time gaining employment. And so they're just kind of doing pop-ups. It's hard out here. You know, we've chosen an industry with razor thin margins, and that couldn't afford a disruption that would last longer than a few weeks. And now we're a year into this.
And again, you can't really count on things snapping back to normal.
No.
If 100% of the people were vaccinated next week.
Right. Well, you know, everybody likes to say the new normal. And we've been hearing that term thrown around or that terminology thrown around over the last year. But a good friend of mine in New York City, he owns several bars that are well-regarded, and he's calling it New Earth because, again, we don't really know what it is. And he likens it to the analogy of leaving on a ship. And all we know is that we left the old world behind and we're heading to the new world. We don't really know what we're going to find when we get there. And that's really, like I addressed earlier with you, is we don't really know what to prepare for because all possibilities are open. You know, this is an opportunity to fix some of the... I guess to fix some of the problems that we have in the hospitality industry with wages, hopefully food costs as well. People will be willing to pay more what the food's worth and be able to pay people more. In addition to that, you know, it's just really, really hard to prepare for the negative aspects of what may come.
My thanks again to Mickey Shuey, Adam Broderick, and Ed Rudisill. Mickey has a story in the latest issue of IBJ about the ramifications of office tenants deciding to allow some workers to remain remote, at least part of the time. You can check it out at IBJ.com. And before you get on with the rest of your week, I'd like to draw your attention to some other strong stories in this week's IBJ. First up, dozens of clients of the Carmel-based investment firm Indie Asset Partners are concerned they're at risk of losing a big chunk of the tens of millions of dollars that went into a New York hedge fund as part of what was supposed to be a risk diversification strategy. Greg Andrews explains what went wrong. Also in this week's issue, Susan Orr delves into a report from the Brookings Institution that finds entrepreneurship is sluggish in Indiana, and that, as a result, the state is not as well positioned as it might be to rebound from economic downturns. And Anthony Shutley reports that media coverage of Indianapolis's stint hosting all of March Madness could bring an enormous payoff for the city, state, and the venues hosting the lion's share of the games. And again, you can read these stories in the latest print edition of IBJ or online at IBJ.com. I will say it's quite a bit easier to access all of the latest news and all of IBJ's data on Central Indiana's business community and economy if you're a subscriber. It works out to about $2 per week for actionable information you're not going to find anywhere else. Just go to IBJ.com and click on the subscribe button. Thanks again for making time this week for the IBJ podcast, which is edited by Leslie Weidenbender. I'm Mason King. Hang in there, everybody. We'll be back again next week.